Good afternoon, everybody. It's a huge pleasure to be here at Chalk Valley again. And all the more so, I'm sure we can all share a common sense of relief that unlike the poor, poor NATO leaders in The Hague earlier this week, absolutely nobody here need feel obliged to say a nice word about Donald Trump. In Normandy, late on the morning of the 6th of June 1944, a British commando found himself face to face with a wounded prisoner whom he just shot in the stomach. The enemy was a 15-year-old from Graz in Austria who screamed in his agony. The commando, who was himself not that much older, asked his unit interpreter the German word for sorry. He then kept repeating to the prisoner, "Verzeihung, Verzeihung." He asked the interpreter to explain to his victim that he'd never shot anybody before. This month marks the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, bloodiest struggle in human history. I've spent much of my life studying conflict. An implicit theme of the books which I write today is the case for us to sustain commemoration. Even in 2025, to continue to look back at what we can learn from the experiences and sacrifices of that generation, now almost all in their graves. In times gone by, I published a succession of widescreen views of the 20th century's wars. Nowadays, however, my instrument of choice is a microscope to explore in detail what happened to relatively small numbers of participants in what almost always proved to have been the most extraordinary phase of their lives. I'm no longer much interested in generals. Instead, I focus on little people and what it was like to do the sort of extraordinary things that ordinary soldiers are called upon to do, prominent among which is to kill people and, when necessary, themselves to die by violence. Some things spark my interest, which don't catch the attention of many historians. For instance, the impact of battle on men's bodily functions. There's no reason to suppose that these operated any differently among invaders landing in Normandy from those recorded by Americans landing in the Pacific, who found that in conditions of extreme fear, one man in five lost control of his bowels and one in 10 urinated in his trousers, neither a great booster to morale in the hours that followed their 6th June scramble onto the sand. Let me give you another example of the sort of things that grip me, which is particular to sword. In one action, inland from the beaches, an infantry battalion took more than 7 hours to capture a German strong point, which was delaying the entire division's advance. Yet in the end, that unit lost only 7 killed. What caught my eye was the fact that almost all of those who died were officers or NCOs. And this told an old cynic like me that the battalion's leaders paid a heavy price for showing the way, where not many of their men were willing to follow. That happens much more often than most history books record. In battle, a gallant leader leaps to his feet and shouts, "Come on, chaps!" And he goes on to do or die, but often finds himself almost alone. I quote in my book the experience of a commando wounded on sword, who days later found himself in an English hospital beside a colonel who told him that his grandfather and father had commanded the very same battalion as himself in earlier wars. On its first day in action in Normandy, quote, he found that his soldiers wouldn't follow him into an attack, and he himself had been shot. The commander who recounted this concluded, he did not seem to be very badly wounded, but one morning I woke to find that he died in the night. I think he died of shame. My book is partly the story of a baptism of fire, of how 35,000 men, few of whom had ever before had a shot fired in anger, landed on Sword Beach and with the adjoining 6th Airborne Division. But though I use this fragment of D-Day as a peg, my wider purpose is to explain what it was like to be a British soldier in the war, most of whom spent only a tiny portion of their service on battlefields. Before we, all those men, hear the sounds and view the spectacle of the invaders' collision with Hitler's Atlantic Wall, I try to explain something of their lives and thoughts during the long years before battle was joined. Try to imagine what their experience was like compared with our own incredibly privileged existences. Privileged because we have constant freedom of choices, such as millions of wartime soldiers were denied through their precious youths, captives in uniform. Between Dunkirk in 1940 and D-Day in 1944, most of the army was not seeking glory in the desert or fighting the Japanese in Burma. Its units instead lingered training in England, unimaginably bored. They knew that the world around them was in flames, but day upon day and month after month, clad in itchy serge battle dress, they themselves endured kit inspections, route marches, weapon training, leavened only by more food than was conceded to civilians, and by the occasional moderate bliss of a weekend leave. There was a rueful joke during the Luftwaffe blitz that most of Britain's soldiers were employed knitting socks for the civilians in the trenches. At first, they formed a garrison deployed to defend against threatened invasion. An infantry officer cherished the memory of a visit to his unit by the Prime Minister in the summer of 1940. Churchill stuck a mischievous thumb in the wet concrete of one of their new pillboxes, inscribing his initials, WSC. Later, in those dark days, Britain's leader delivered one of his finest BBC broadcasts to the people of occupied France. "Good night, then," said Churchill, bidding farewell to his wireless audience across the channel. "Sleep to gather strength for the morning will come. Brightly will it shine on the brave and true, and kindly on all who suffer for the cause, and gloriously upon the tombs of heroes. Thus shall shine the dawn." Yet almost four apparently interminable years passed before Churchill's great vision of liberation began to be fulfilled. The poet Keith Douglas, a youthful army recruit, was equivocal in his own mingled apprehension and curiosity. During training, he sent some lines to a woman friend. "And when I prepare to die behind my gun, I shall not glow with fervor like a sun. Then whatever will restrain the coward reasoning closely in my brain, I think it will be that I am mad to see the whole performance and what the end will be." This last ambition for personal survival represented a privilege for which all wartime humankind hungered. Though the likes of Douglas had donned battle dress, their distant vision was not of winning glory, but instead of completing an unwelcome duty so that they could return to their real lives in offices and factories, homes and schools, on beaches where they might build sandcastles with the children they dreamt of fathering. This was an outcome which more than a few would be denied, including Keith Douglas. It's hard to overstate the frustration suffered by the majority of British soldiers who saw no battlefields during those years between the army's expulsion from France and return to it. They'd been plucked from mostly humdrum, but at least sheltered lives, jobs, and families to experience season after season of sun, rain, snow, mud in hutted camps or on wasteland training areas, often in the company of men with whom they had little sympathy, rehearsing the skills of battle, yet denied the chance to practice them. Tobruk and Alamein, Stalingrad and Kursk, Sicily and Salerno came and went. Yet in England, men repeated the same routines, fatigues, exercises, drills. "War seems to be mostly hanging around," said a rueful 1941 officer in Evelyn Waugh's contemporary fictional portrait. Wartime armies are fundamentally uncivilized institutions. Training, wrote one such victim, was designed to transform sloppy civilians into soldiers, and it wasn't done by kindness either. We were marched and yelled at up and down the barrack square. We were cursed, humiliated, degraded, and worked until we were fit to drop. At the end of each day, we were allowed to relax by sitting beside our beds, polishing and burnishing a bewildering array of equipment. The armed forces communicated in a strange language of acronyms, which spilled over into civilian Britain. Tommy Handley's vastly popular BBC radio show was called ITMAR, It's That Man Again. A generation, including King George VI, learnt to laugh at his injunction, NCTW, WASB, never clean the window with a soft-boiled egg. They bid farewell to each other with one of the show's catchphrases, TTFN, ta-ta for now. A soldier wrote that army life made him feel a lesser creature. To thrive on a few encouraging words from an unthinking oaf in authority, to delight in a cup of bad tea and a cigarette snatched between parades, to laugh inordinately at clumsy humour, or to be moved almost to tears by another's misfortunes, these were not the natural preoccupations of a mature and fairly experienced mind. Yet in all those years, they were mine. The novelist Anne Nepal, who served as an elderly subaltern, wrote of that terrible recurrent army dejection, the sensation that no one cares a halfpenny whether you live or die. There was an enduring popular myth that mess tea and cocoa were laced with something which curbed soldiers' interests in sex. Len Waller decided this must be true after spending a week's leave at home. His wife said that she'd been, quote, very disappointed in my prowess as a lover. Most garrison soldiers yearned for useful activity. Major John Howard, who on D-Day would undertake one of the invader's most dramatic roles by leading his glider-borne company to seize what became Pegasus Bridge, struggled for years beforehand to assuage his men's boredom, indeed depression. They were once sent for 2 months cliff climbing in Devon and then ordered to march 130 miles back to their barracks simply to wear them out. Who could be surprised by the desertions, collapses of morale, suicides? By 1944, some people who should have known better were losing patience as they awaited the titanic clash in France, which, after apparently interminable delay, was now finally approaching. On the 4th of March, the Archbishop of Canterbury wrote testily to the King's private secretary, Tommy Lascelles, urging that the generals should hurry up and choose a date. The primate was concerned that this might clash with Easter or Palm Sunday, and he wished to arrange a day of prayer before the invasion. Lascelles observed dryly, "He is in some ways most curiously out of touch with realities." Many men of the armies nonetheless shared the Archbishop's eagerness. D-Day was not, as our parents and grandparents, generations of British and Canadian and American people fondly believe, the decisive event of World War II. But it was the preeminent landmark of Britain's struggle, representing the moment of rehabilitation after all the defeats and humiliations which Churchill's nation had suffered since 1940. In mid-May, Major George Appleton, who was to command a beach group on Sword, enjoyed a luxurious last leave in London. He stayed at the Savoy, dined off lobster at the Ecu de France, and saw several shows. Perhaps he knew the lines of Robert Browning. "I shut my eyes and turn them on my heart. As a man calls for wine before he fights, I asked one draught of earlier, happier sights, ere fitly I could hope to play my part. Think first, fight afterwards, the soldier's art." On the night of the 5th of June, 1944, at Harwell Airfield in Berkshire, as paras and glider troops embarked, BBC correspondent Chester Wilmot quizzed some pathfinders about their earlier lives. One had been a hod carrier on building sites, another a Kent toolmaker. There were also an Edinburgh bricklayer, a Worcestershire fox hunt kennelman, a Dumfries lorry driver. There were two pre-war regular soldiers, a deserter from the Irish army, an Austrian Jewish refugee. They were led by a young lieutenant who had performed in the chorus line of a West End musical comedy. Many of those who landed from the air were delivered to the battlefield by glider. In our own morbidly risk-averse era, we should feel a sense of awe that thousands entrusted their lives to these craft constructed of plywood and canvas, frail as gigantic child's toys. It defied probability that hundreds of such weird artifacts, unique to that brief season as tools of war, completed passages to France and offloaded cargoes of men and guns. An officer wrote of arriving in Normandy by glider, "The landing was ghastly. Mine was the first plane down, though we weren't quite in the right place, and the damn thing bucketed across the very upsy-downsy field and then broke across the middle." When many men came under enemy fire for the first time, they stopped and dived to the ground. Some quickly rose again and pressed on, but others reported themselves as pinned down while they awaited support from tanks or artillery, or merely hugged cover until they could be induced by their officers to move again. Sir Alan Brooke, head of the army, wrote irascibly to a fellow general, "We are not anything like as tough as we were in the last war. There's been far too much luxury, safety first, red triangle, etc. in this country. Our one idea is to look after our comforts and avoid being hurt." Colonel Jim Eadie, commanding the Staffordshire Yeomanry, once wrote to his wife from the North African desert, "Our chaps don't always seem to be conscious that it's a struggle the results of which mean total gain or total loss of everything we hold dear. The only way to win is to destroy enough of the German army. I have nothing derogatory to say of the courage of British soldiers, but when one sees the enormous percentage of our chaps taken prisoner, be it in Singapore, Greece, Tobruk, or where you like, as compared with our actual casualties, one wonders if they really appreciate that it's so much more than a game in which you can throw in your hand when you feel beaten. There seems a lack of fighting spirit, which must be imbued into men all through their training. Leadership is everything." In June 1944, the Army's senior officers and Britain's Prime Minister remained, after so many earlier defeats, fearful that their soldiers were still no match for Hitler's. The most rewarding way to view the 6th of June in Normandy is not as a huge canvas, but instead as a succession of miniature dramas performed in adjoining theatres. They were, of course, connected, but in the minds of their participants, each was a very private epic in which men were conscious only of their mates to right and left. Contrary to Brooke's ruderies, it never ceases to amaze me that men were successfully conditioned to perform attacks which were highly likely to get them killed. Think of the assault on the Merville battery performed by nine para who dropped into Normandy in the most chaotic landings of the night, which caused some men to end up 20 miles from their objective. I once took part in a battalion night parachute drop in Cyprus, which was a chaotic shambles. And I remember thinking in 1963 that if this was what happened when there wasn't even an enemy, it was easier to imagine how much worse it was in 1944. 29-year-old Colonel Terence Otway was obliged to lead the storming of the Merville with just 1/5 of his men and none of their heavy weapons and equipment. One of his officers had to probe a path through the German minefield with his bare hands. The attackers lost about half their strength getting through to the guns, which then turned out to be much smaller and thus less dangerous to the beach landings than the planners had feared. And the worst part was that once the survivors stormed the battery, they lacked engineers and explosives with which to destroy it. Like so many acts of courage in wars, this one wasted lives, though that should not diminish our admiration for the men who carried it out. Otway wrote to his wife Stella a few days later, lamenting the deaths of so many officers whom she'd met. Peters, that tall chap who came into the Checkers at Newbury with his wife. Tom Halliburton, the little Scotsman who helped you decorate the Christmas tree. Mike Dowling, that ugly-looking but pleasant-faced Irishman from the Ulster Rifles. Some of the 400 men who were missing when Nineparra charged the Merville rejoined later, but many did not. And now let us see some of the sights that were seen by the men who landed on Sword from the sea, filmed by army cameramen on the 6th of June, 1944. Battalions which landed first from the sea on Sword were warned that they might suffer 50% casualties. Some companies made it almost unscathed, but others were terribly mauled. The South Lancs lost their colonel and 3 out of 4 company commanders, all killed or wounded in the first 3 minutes. Some men dashed onward from the beach to the German strong points behind them, but others obeyed human instinct and burrowed into the sand or even the water. They paid the price through the hours that followed amid German shelling and mortaring. Think what it took to push on when you saw men falling all around you. Keith Wakelam, a 22-year-old commander, had volunteered to go ashore with the spearhead in a mood of despair, prompted by consciousness that his marriage was a failure. I'd expected too much of Beryl. She was a fun-loving party-goer, and I was serious, jealous, demanding. Terry Skelly was celebrating his 20th birthday. He wrote, "I was just starting down the port ramp when our craft gave a lurch as it was severely hit, depositing me in 5 feet of water. I was rolled over and over underwater until I came to rest beside the body of a man jammed against a beach obstacle. I could clearly see his dead face with his eyes open and read his East York's titles. I pulled myself to my feet and started for the beach with water up to my chest. I was amazed to see a lot of soldiers huddled, apparently stopped by one strand of barbed wire. The assault brigade was paying a terrible price for not getting off quickly enough." Signaller Norman Barker's first impression was of the, quote, "indescribable noise. It was all incredible and fascinating, and my main feelings were curiosity and amazement, surrounded by hundreds of ships and people and things. I wasn't frightened, rather foolishly the opposite. Tolstoy's Pierre Bezukhov had experienced the same sensations at Borodino and Keith Douglas in the desert, that in a man's first action, curiosity could be as powerful a driver as fear. Douglas wrote, "I was like a child in a factory. A child sees the brightness and efficiency of steel machines and endless belts slapping round and round without caring or knowing what it's all there for." Later, when a soldier better understood the significance of the deadly threats all around him, that changed. Fascination was supplanted by an educated apprehension, sometimes raw terror. One of the most famous figures to land on sword was 32-year-old Brigadier Lord Lovat, accompanied by his personal piper and four commando units. He was a supreme exemplar of a vanishing species, the warrior Toff. The chief of Clan Fraser, a pre-war Scots Guards officer, he was distinguished by unshakable courage, film star looks, and an arrogance that had won the respect of Lord Cardigan of the Light Brigade. In his memoirs, Lovat writes with contempt of almost all those with whom he served, save his own followers, whom he adored. And they, strangely enough, in a Britain on the cusp of socialism, adored him. Harry Drew, who landed expecting the worst, touched his brigadier's belt on the beach so that if he was killed, at least they could say that Private Drew died fighting alongside Lord Lovat. Between June 1944 and May 1945, a rifleman who landed on D-Day was more likely to be hit than not and faced a 1 in 10 chance of dying, rising to 1 in 4 if he was an officer. Many became so convinced that death must be their fate that they learnt to welcome mere injury, especially a coveted blighty one, a wound severe enough to justify a passage home, but not threatening life and limb. A major who sought to reassure a man weeping after being slightly hit was quickly disabused of the illusion that the victim was unhappy. "It's the relief, sir. It's such a relief." Once the German coastal defences were penetrated, reinforcement units passed through the Spearhead Battalion on a drive inland that Montgomery demanded should reach the city of Caen before nightfall. Several of the German strong points in their path collapsed and surrendered after offering minimum resistance. But at one, codenamed Hillman, the Suffolks lingered for 7 hours from their first attack to a successful breakthrough. Everything took too long. At the outset, officers crawled forward to reconnoitre, and then they waited for an artillery barrage. Then they led the way forward under machine gun fire from Hillman. One of its German defenders, who watched their progress through a periscope, later testified, "They were advancing very slowly, very cautiously. One advances, stops, waits. Another advances. They seemed extremely cautious, looking everywhere before moving forward, as much as a meter." Three officers and two NCOs were shot down as they tried to break through the Hillman wire, trenches and minefields. There were long delays after each mishap, and runners were sent to the rear. Engineers were summoned. New artillery barrages were arranged. Tanks were called in, one of whom's drivers suddenly stopped because he refused to pass over a British corpse in his path. Hour after hour, other battalions lingered in the nearby village of Colville, waiting for Hillman to be cleared. A bitter Suffolk officer said later, "Everybody cursed us, saying, 'Why the hell don't you get on with it? My CO had a lot of hard things said about him. It was quite wrong.'" In truth, the Suffolks were indeed very slow, as their few casualties attest. There was a striking contrast between the performance of 9 Para, which had stormed the Merville Battery 12 hours earlier, and the showing of the Suffolks. It's most unlikely that, as the great Australian war correspondent Chester Wilmot claimed, their dallying prevented the British from getting to Caen on D-Day. That achievement was never plausible. But what happened at Hillman showed what could go wrong on a battlefield where men recoiled from the sort of sacrifices that would have been necessary to storm Hillman quickly. Wilmot, who became an authoritative post-war historian of the campaign, wrote of the gravest shortcoming of the British Army, the reluctance of commanders at all levels to call on their troops to press on regardless of losses, even in operations which were likely to shorten the war and thus save casualties in the long run. Ronald Lewin, a distinguished war historian who served as a gunner in Normandy, wrote likewise, without the massive support of artillery and armor, our infantry was too often disposed to be sluggish and unambitious. Yet even as Hillman was still holding out against the Suffolks, a mile or two away, another British regiment was giving a textbook lesson in how to fight a tank battle. Montgomery had brought back from the Mediterranean some experienced units to stiffen the novices on D-Day. Among these was the Staffordshire Yeomanry, a county territorial regiment which had sailed to the Middle East in 1940 with its beloved horses, and 4 years later still referred to its unbeloved tanks as mounts and their crews as jockeys. Many of its officers were country gentlemen and fox hunters, some of the men tenants on local estates. Yet even if they'd been amateur soldiers when they went to war, by 1944 they were immensely battle savvy, not least their colonel, Jim Eady, old for his role at 44, who until he donned uniform had run a brewery. He wrote to his adored wife, Nadiana, apologizing for having broken down and cried at what he had known was their last meeting before he set forth for Normandy. I was so ashamed of myself when we parted. Thank God you have courage enough for the two of us. It's far worse to be left behind. And I so truly realize that you can control yourself when I cannot. I don't think I really lack courage. It's just some wave of feeling that quite overcomes me for the moment. You're right that this time it won't be for 4 years. But I have so much better a realization of what the battlefield means. The ignorant are usually better than the experienced ones. In the late afternoon of the 6th of June, 60 tanks of 21st Panzer Division delivered the only major German armored thrust of D-Day. Eady had told Nadiana before embarking, there's no flush of excitement within me, such as one gets at one's first battle, just a steady resolve to do my best as long as my strength shall last. I know experience counts, and I hope mine can stand others in good stead. It did. Eady's Staffordshires brutally punished the attacking panzers. Three times the Germans sought to drive forward into the western flank of the Sword beachhead, and three times their tanks were hammered until at last their commandos recognized that they were beaten and retreated to the ridge above Caen from which they'd started. Eady wrote to his wife, in the end, it wasn't as bad as I'd pictured, and we had a really good shootout with the Hun and completely scored off him. The third battle that I examine in detail in this book is that of the Shropshires on the road to Caen through the afternoon and evening. In this, their first battle, an impressive number of British officers showed themselves willing and even eager to set an example. A company commander in another unit said of those first invasion days, there was a desire to seek glory. There was a real determination to succeed or die in the attempt. The atmosphere was heroic. The leading companies, the Shropshires, marched doggedly south across country towards the tall industrial chimneys of Caen, clearly visible as they ascended the summits of switchback hills before descending into shallow valleys, most of them wooded and thus potentially threatening. The Shropshires had assumed back in England that they'd be advancing in step with the other two battalions of their brigade. The others were, however, miles behind. The men of the point sections knew that there was nothing save deceptively idyllic fields, woods, and golden farmhouses between themselves and the German army, which was hastening to meet them. At every step, apparent tranquility could be shattered by enemy fire. The Shropshires had done little training for street fighting in villages, and they afterwards acknowledged that they advanced too carelessly in full view. The battalion fought a succession of actions against German troops who knew that they couldn't hope to stop the British, but instead merely sought to delay them. And in the words of a Shropshire's officer, delay us they did. The civilians refused to evacuate themselves, and at that stage we were too soft-hearted to shell their homes, a proceeding which might have expedited the whole advance considerably. Every little Norman village with its high walls and narrow streets was ideally suited for riflemen to fire on the invaders from behind cover. Each hamlet needed an hour or two for the infantry to winkle out the enemy. By early evening of the 6th, the weary Shropshires felt themselves tantalizingly close to the old city of Caen, focus of every D-Day ambition of Montgomery, their army commander. Lieutenant Len Murray nonetheless observed that our numbers had shrunk rather alarmingly. It's a quirky footnote that 30 years later, that same Lieutenant Murray became Secretary General of the TUC. The leading company approached a wooded ridge up rising ground, and suddenly bursts of German fire harrowed them. The company commander, named Peter Steele, saw a machine gun ahead and ran towards it. He was shot, dying nearer to Caen, just 3 miles ahead, than any other British officer on D-Day. One of his platoon commanders, Lieutenant Tom Gwilliam, nonetheless said stubbornly, "We must try to take the high ground." Gwilliam crawled further uphill until he reached a cattle trough, and there he told his wireless operator to stop while he himself kept going. Within seconds, there was a new burst of fire, and the lieutenant collapsed, hit in the stomach. Almost miraculously, Gwilliam's platoon sergeant contrived to drag his officer back behind a bank. Stretcher bearers reached them, and Gwilliam survived. One of his soldiers, further back down the hill, said it was all a bit of a shambles. Their colonel now decided not to attack again that night, saying, I think we've come far enough. The Shropshires had displayed notable guts and done all they could as the Germans rushed to reinforce the Labizi Ridge, where the British advance on Caen stuck for almost the next fortnight. Those last hours of D-Day were marked by one more tragic incident, so typical of all battles and all wars. In darkness, a Shropshire's lieutenant was sent out with a sergeant to reconnoitre no man's land. And when the two men returned, the officer called out, "Don't shoot, Mr. Rees." The jumpy defenders nonetheless opened fire, killing Di Rees and his NCO. A soldier said wearily that those responsible were just trigger-happy green troops in the end. Those two dead men were the last of 113 casualties the Shropshires suffered on D-Day. Those battles that I briefly described were typical of many, not merely on the 6th of June, but throughout the war, which is why I explore in detail the whys and wherefores of them in my book. A young platoon commander wrote that in Normandy, "I began to appreciate how vital is grip. Grip on oneself, grip on one's soldiers, grip on the situation. Most men react nervously to real battle conditions. Discipline and regimental pride are supports. But in decisive moments of great danger, if you do not dominate events, your enemy will." As nightfall descended on Normandy, hundreds of thousands of men succumbed to awe about the magnitude of the events in which they were participating. One wrote, quote, "Of all the other impressions of the day, by far the most pronounced at the end of it was surprise and thankfulness that we were still alive to tell the tale." One of the best-loved officers in the army, the East Yorkshire's Major Charles Banger King, took the trouble to write to his batman's mother, "I cannot express too deeply my admiration for the men I've been commanding. When we landed at HR, they went straight over the beaches in spite of a murderous fire, and in half an hour it cleared a gap through which poured the reserve companies, commandos, and it seemed to me about half the British Army. You have every reason to be proud of your son and the part he's played in this damned war." A German soldier said about his feelings on being captured, "At first I was rather depressed, of course. I, an old soldier, a prisoner after a few hours of invasion. But when I saw the materiel behind the enemy front, I could only say, old man, how lucky you have been. Of the British battalions that have been most heavily engaged, the South Lancs lost 107, the East Yorks 206, one-third of its fighting strength. Yet there would have been plenty of days in what became the murderous Normandy campaign when more British and American soldiers died than had perished on the 6th of June, to the astonishment and dismay of those who permitted themselves a sigh of relief on discovering at nightfall that they were still alive. Worse things lay ahead. In Normandy, an infantry battalion lost an average of 36 officers and 809 other ranks killed, wounded, or taken prisoners. Insofar as any event in a war can be characterized as glamorous, D-Day was such an event when Eisenhower's armies and the air and naval forces shared in a vast spectacular, such as the world had never seen before and never would again. A fundamental question facing the units that landed was whether they were expected or required, either by their commanders or their country, to pour forth blood in profusion in order to perform great deeds beyond merely seizing a beachhead. By the standards of the 300 at Thermopylae, of Wellington Squares at Waterloo, some showed themselves cautious, hesitant, slow. Some individuals, mostly officers and NCOs, displayed exemplary courage and will for sacrifice, but this didn't extend to all their men. It seems nonetheless quite mistaken to pass any censure. On Sword Beach and beyond, indeed across every invasion beach on the 6th of June, there was courage enough and sacrifice enough. There was merely not the embrace of self-immolation, which a battle for national survival alone can rightfully demand. Almost every thoughtful soldier who participated in the Normandy campaign was profoundly affected by the experience. Jim Eady wrote home to his wife, "We must indeed, if we are spared, try to help with all we've got to end this madness of war. It's easy at times of stress and imminent danger to resolve to give one's all to ensure that such things shall never happen again. But it's easier to then slip into one's old mode of living when the crisis has passed. I won't do that. I'm resolved to use what life I have left to add to the happiness of mankind and to make good to those who've suffered." Those sentiments might sound to some 21st century people mawkish, but they reflect the emotions of a courageous soldier appalled by the scenes that he'd witnessed, the dead men whom he'd known. The colonel of another unit warned his men before the 6th of June, "Those first days are going to be exhausting and probably absolute hell. We must have confidence that we're going to do it better than the other side." And so they did. It's sad to end by telling you that the young commando who apologized profusely to the German soldier for shooting him on D-Day was himself killed the very next day. It's right that the descendants of himself and of all his comrades, together with our country, should honor their memories in this 80th year since the Allies celebrated the victorious ending of the Second World War. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Right, we've got a little bit of time for some questions, so we'll crack on as much as we can. And I'm looking over there. And do shout like mad, because I'm terribly deaf.
I bought your book because I read a review of it by a history professor at St. Andrews University who described my father-in-law as an arse. And I thought, why has this twerp, this history professor, called Lord Lovat an arse? I then read your book, which, to be honest, I enjoyed. And then we get a big paragraph about my father-in-law. But at the end, a stupid sentence. To modern minds, the chieftain totters between ridicule and repugnance. How dare you put that in your book? If I'd been your editor, I'd have removed it immediately.
I can't say anything in response to that. I only hope that if I was ever written about in the terms that I wrote about Lovett, that one of my descendants would rally to my support with the courage and determination that you have.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for such a wonderful talk this afternoon. You mentioned my uncle served in the Shropshire Light Infantry. When they were at Caen, do you know where they went after that at all?
Where they went after Caen? Yes. To be truthful, no. But I do know that they had, like all the other infantry battalions that landed on D-Day, they had a very, very rough time.
My uncle died on the 21st of September 1944. So, but thank you.
That's getting a bit ahead of me.
So, Max, thank you very much for that wonderful exposition of the personal side of several regiments that had taken part on the first day of D-Day. One lot of people that you don't mention and which I always find were incredibly brave and had the most terrible tasks to undertake were the Padres.
No, I couldn't agree more that the Padres, it's very noticeable that many Padres, well, in fact, I have written about several Padres in the book, one in particular, the Padre of Nine Para, after the storming of the Merdwell, managed to get hold of a captured vehicle and drove not once but twice through the German lines to where the wounded from the attack were lying and brought them back in batches to the British regimental aid post. And he did that unarmed, on his own with a driver. And many Padres performed similar feats of courage. But you're absolutely right to point out that they were an enormous... Padres, it's extraordinary the example they often set and the wonderful stuff they often did.
How did Jim Eadie die?
How did Jim Eadie... he died at the age of 60 in 1960, having just sat down in an armchair at home and said he just had the best day his fox hunting he'd ever had in his life.
Thank you very much. Two sort of related questions. Was there any point where the Germans could have won in the early part of D-Day? I mean, was there any point where the Germans could have tactically done something different to drive the Allies back? And secondly, are there any accounts of what the Germans thought, what the Germans' ordinary soldiers were thinking as we rolled through their lines?
The British were phenomenally lucky that as a result of an endless procession of command cock-ups, that they didn't get their panzers onto the battlefield until that afternoon. If they'd, as they well could have done, having been the 21st Panzer Division, having been alerted at 4 o'clock in the morning, if they'd moved immediately, they could have hit Sword Beachhead before the Staffordshire Yeomanry got ashore, before the British were, they could have caused absolute havoc. I don't believe they could actually have reversed the course of D-Day because the British and the Americans and the Canadians were too strong. But I do think the British were fantastically lucky. And one must never underestimate the importance of luck on every battlefield. And on, earlier in the war, the British had often had the worst of the luck. Sometimes later in the war, and especially on D-Day, the luck went with them and the luck went entirely against the Germans.
At this stage, presumably the Germans have some surety that they're losing the war. Were there examples of outstanding courage on the part of the Germans on D-Day?
Well, I remember years and years ago when I wrote an earlier book about the Normandy campaign, Overlord. And in those days, many, many senior officers were still alive, and I interviewed them. One of them I interviewed was Brigadier Bill Williams, who was Montgomery's chief of intelligence. And he was an Oxford Don who was at pains to say to me that all he wanted to do the whole war was just get the whole thing finished and go back to his proper life. But he said sometimes when he was interviewing captured German officers that he would say to them, well, it's obvious the war's over. Why are you keeping this thing going? And he said they click their heels and say, well, as long as there's a Heimat, we will continue to defend it. And Bill Williams said to me, he said, sometimes we got an awful feeling the Germans didn't mind doing this. And he was being a little bit facetious, but nonetheless, it is quite extraordinary that so many Germans went on and on to the very end. And it was extraordinary because one's seen, I've sometimes in my young days as a war correspondent, that I've sometimes been at situations like the end in Vietnam and so on, when the whole society collapsed and the army collapsed and everything collapsed and the last battles were, and here with these Germans, they went on and on to the end. And it was quite extraordinary, and it baffled and frequently distressed the British because they felt, and the Americans, because they felt, here are we, all we're asking, when, as you so rightly said, the end was foreordained, and they insisted on keeping going. It was a sort of madness.
How important was it that the Germans were alleged to be expecting invasion at Calais? And have all their divisions in the wrong place?
It was important. Deception, sometimes other parts of the war, deception did not play an important part. There's no question it did play an important part on D-Day. And one of the things that always strikes me, although I've sometimes got myself in trouble by writing that I thought that the German army as a fighting institution was more effective than the British army or the American army, on the other hand, the British war machine, in the absolute sense, the way in which the whole of Britain made war was far more effective than the way that Germany made war, or even that Russia made war on America. Yes, America did fantastic things industrially, but Britain's exploitation of talent, and especially talent in putting clever people into intelligence, because I'm afraid one of the oldest jokes about intelligence, it's jolly difficult to find enough half-clever people to be in intelligence. But during the war, there were a lot of clever people, and they did fabulous things.
I just wonder what your thoughts would be on the state of, or on the interaction of human psyche and warfare, given the technological evolution that we seem to be making. Sorry, just... maybe it's not a terribly pertinent question. Well, definitely isn't from a World War II perspective.
It
really is not. But drone technology and technological advances have really changed or seem to be changing the nature of warfare. Haven't quite yet, but are about to. And I wonder how you think that affects the psyche of warfare.
I think it becomes more difficult. In a world war, everybody's in it together. And there's no doubt one of the things I've often found about people coming back from Britain's other wars in more recent times, that they've found it terribly difficult, especially those who were wounded or disabled, to integrate into a civilian society that understands nothing about them. And the best thing they had going, everybody knew what it was about. Whereas a few years later, when I wrote a book about the Korean War, and it was heartbreaking for the men who were out there fighting in Korea, to find that people at home knew nothing at all about what they were doing. And so the most important thing is to feel that your country is with you and the people around you are with you.
Thank you. I was very pleased to see that you included a clip of the D-Day landings, and I think films, contemporary films like that, are very important today because they bring home to a generation that lives with TikTok and YouTube, and they actually do find that real films can be of real benefit to everybody. Now, we have a friend whose father went to D-Day, and he never knew him. He basically was born after his father was killed. Many years later, his widow said to her son, "I'd like to go back to Pegasus Bridge and see where your father was killed." So they went back to Pegasus Bridge and started looking at the mock rider that was left over. And one of the helpers in the museum said, "How can we help you?" And he said, "My father was killed here and I don't know very much about him. They said, well, tell us his name and see what we can do. So they went away, and 10 minutes later, they produced a film of the father leaning against the tank with a pipe, looking at a map that had been taken at the time. That film had been seen many times on BBC and other programs, but he'd never realized that it was his father. So I think it's very important to maintain those old films as a relic of what happened during the war for the benefit of everybody.
I agree. Am I bombarded everybody into silence? Oh, no.
You talk very well indeed about the private soldier and the citizen soldier going in his first experience of war. How do you feel the new Gen Z, millennials, et cetera, the TikTok generation we've just been hearing, how do you feel from your experience that they would react to such situations?
Another generation, yeah. I think it's very difficult for them. That I frequently discuss this with modern soldiers, and some are very optimistic about what young men will do, and others more cautious. That I think it is more difficult when your society does not appear directly threatened. I mean, we have a problem in persuading the British people at the moment that defence ought to be a vital priority, when in fact it comes down somewhere beyond below gender modification in most governments' priorities. It's very difficult when you don't see your own society being threatened to put yourself at risk. And I remember when my own son was at school, I thought that a life in the army might suit him. And he wasn't having any and went off and very sensibly did his own thing. And today I do feel the gratitude because, by God, I've seen some of the young men who were very badly wounded in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I used to think when I was young, and even more stupid than what is now, that war and soldiering was just an adventure. And of course, it's not an adventure. It's an experience that is perfectly dreadful for everybody. And especially, dare I say, for women. I remember when my father and some of his friends were telling war stories when I was a child. And when they'd finished and they'd left the room, my mother would say, don't listen to your father drivelling about what a wonderful time he had in the war. The war was pure hell from beginning to end, the separations and the loneliness and the sacrifices and so on. And my mother was absolutely right. And so now I think one will never know until we're tested, which pray God we won't be in any of our lifetimes or our children's lifetimes, what a new generation would do. There'll always be young men and women who want to have adventures, but there are better ways to have adventures than in wars. Thank you. Thank you.